This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
The story you were about to see was inspired by actual events. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
My guest, Waylon Greene, is executive producer of Dragnet, the new version of the famous 50s crime series. Greene is no stranger to crime. He wrote for Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue and worked as an executive producer and head writer on Law and Order. The creator of Law and Order, Dick Wolf, also created the new Dragnet. Waylon Greene won a screenwriting Oscar nomination for his 1969 film The Wild Bunch, which was directed by Sam Peckinpah. He won an Oscar for directing the 1971 film The Hellstrom Chronicle, about man's struggle against the insect world. He also wrote the screenplays for The High-Low Country, Dinosaur, and The Bodyguard. The new Dragnet stars Ed O'Neill, who played the father in the sitcom Married with Children. Now he plays the cop made famous by Jack Webb, Sergeant Joe Friday.
It was Friday. It was sunny in Los Angeles. My partner and I were working the day shift at a robbery-homicide. The call came in at 8:30. Caucasian male dumped off Mulholland. I love L.A. Starting another day at the top of the world. My name's Friday. I'm a cop.
Waylon Greene told me that one of the reasons he wanted to remake Dragnet was that he wanted to do a crime series set in Los Angeles. I asked him why.
I wanted to set the Dragnet in Los Angeles, or a cop show in Los Angeles, because there are very few cop shows on television that have been set in Los Angeles and worked. It's a very hard place to do one. You don't have precincts, and you don't have that kind of proscenium, you know, stage where you can cross all your characters over and they all run into each other and interact with their lives and so forth. L.A. is a very different place that way.
I don't know if you were in on the casting or not. But, you know, Ed O'Neill, because of his comedic part on Married with Children and because he was such like the doofus on that show, seems like he would have been a long shot to play a Sergeant Joe Friday on Dragnet. He's very good in the role. I don't know if you were in on the casting, but if you were, what made you have the confidence in him? Because it's such a distance to travel.
Well, yes, actually, I was very much in on the casting because I thought Ed O'Neill was right for it because I had worked on a short-lived series called Big Apple, and which Ed O'Neill was in and played a New York detective. And I thought he was the consummate detective. And I think what also probably helped me is that Married with Children, I think I'd only seen it, I hope Ed isn't listening, but I think I'd only seen it two or three times. But I also remembered he was in Cruising. He had played, he had been Eddie Egan in a TV version of French Connection. So my view of him was a cop. And I knew he played a New York cop in Big Apple, but I knew he wasn't from New York. I mean, I knew him. I'd obviously met him and, you know, interacted with him on that series. I knew he was from Youngstown, Ohio. And I thought he had exactly the right, I mean, to me, he was the only guy to play Joe Friday.
The cases from Dragnet are inspired by real cases. Where do you go looking for the real cases?
Well, we don't always go looking for the real cases. Sometimes the cases come looking for us. I mean, we read a lot and we search for things, but occasionally, you know, like Bill Stoner, who's an RHD. Sheriff's RHD guy, who's our technical advisor, will be on the set, and he'll be talking about the way we're staging a crime scene and just, you know, offhandedly say, I remember once coming to, and tells a story or an anecdote, and that becomes something that we look for and look into, and that might become an episode. A lot of these things come from sitting down and talking about, for example, the phenomena of family annihilators, where it just so happened that three, myself and two other members of the writing staff, had seen a documentary about this family annihilator in Georgia and one in Virginia. I'd seen about the one in Georgia. They'd seen the one about the guy in Virginia. And we started talking about it and thought, you know, that's such a really weird and scary phenomenon. There's probably a pretty good show in that.
What is a family annihilator?
A family annihilator is someone, I guess Lizzie Borden would be the first family annihilator, that, you know, in American recorded history. But it's someone who takes it on themselves to murder members of their family. And they usually do it on a spree. They start and just start killing. And it's an interesting kind of show because it's not about the investigation of the crime. You know who did it. I mean, you know in the beginning who did it. But you have to outthink this person because they would not only murder members of their family, they'll murder people they consider members of their family or somehow related to their family. So they can go into the workplace and kill. They can go to someone who is a distant relative or a, you know, an ex-spouse or something like that. I mean, you just, so it becomes this kind of nightmare of second-guessing them. And it made quite a good show.
In the premiere episode of Dragnet, the first victim is a prostitute who's been raped. Semen is found around her vagina and anus, and spray paint is found inside her. You know, I'm thinking in the original Law and Order, I mean, in the original Dragnet, like, I don't know that Joe Friday could possibly have ever uttered words like that. I don't think anybody had genitals on TV then.
Well, that's very true. I mean, Dragnet was, I mean, you know, Dragnet, the original Dragnet was originally a show derived from a radio show that was derived from Chief Parker's relationship with Jack Webb, who wanted to put a show on that made, put a good face on the Los Angeles Police Department, which had had a long period of really kind of heavy-duty corruption, and it was very tainted. And they kept it very, you know, also, I mean, it was the times. You wouldn't have said any of those things in the 50s or early 60s. But, you know, it's a different world now, and people have been exposed on television, even on the reality shows that you see on cable. I mean, you see very graphic crime scene photos. You hear very explicit details of forensic analysis. You hear detailed descriptions of horrendous crimes and even occasionally interviews with people who've committed them describing, you know, what they've done. So I just think, I mean, to be part of today and to do a show like this, which it is a cop show and cops deal with very bad people. I mean, that's really what you have to do. We did actually draw the description of these crimes and what had been done from the crimes committed by Bruno and Bianchi here, when, you know, the real Hillside Stranglers. Mm. And we wanted to revisit that case, but we didn't want to, like, redo it with fictional characters, so we invented a copycat, you know, and then re-examined the case from that point of view.
Did you go back and watch any of the original Dragnet before writing the new series?
I actually didn't. A couple of times I looked at, like, the openings, and I listened to the opening narration, and, you know, somebody gave me a couple of them to look at, but by then we were already designing the show, and I thought, you know, I think I have an idea of what we're going to do here, and so I didn't look at them. And now I have about four of them on CDs that, a friend of mine, David Mills, actually, who executive produces Kingpin, sent me four Dragnet episodes. And I'm going to look at them.
Okay. Now, you were an executive producer on Law & Order. Mm-hmm. At any given moment of the day, some station or another seems to be playing some episode of Law & Order, either the original or one of the spin-offs. You must have asked yourself, why did it catch on the way it did? Why? How did it become such a phenomenon?
Well, I always thought, you know, it's interesting because I was on it the third and fourth season, and it wasn't that popular. It was pretty solid, and it had a very good return audience that built little by little. The network wasn't thrilled with it and always thought it would tank at some point. We're sort of laying for it. And but I noticed that no matter what was on opposite the show, you know, there was a core of people who wanted that kind of story-driven show, and they kept coming there. And I think people started finding it when it went on to cable whilst it was on network television. And I think people started finding it in two places and then coming back to the original. And I think it works, I mean, for to a great extent, because it's a clever show. It's very well written. It has very good twists and turns. About the time you burn out on the police part of it, then you come into the legal, which might completely unravel the first half of the show. And it's just satisfying storytelling.
Part of the appeal of Law and Order and Dragnet is the mystery. There's a crime that needs to be solved. And, you know, the viewer is trying to solve it more quickly than the detectives solve it. How far ahead of the viewers do you want your detectives to be?
Just one step. Usually if the viewers are very sharp, you know, and if Joe Friday gets a hunch, you can't actually reveal the hunch too well, because as soon as they think Friday got a hunch, he's probably right. And so the viewers will jump you there. But you play that like a chess game, where you try to stay a move or two ahead of the audience, but you don't want to get too far ahead of them, because then, you know, I think it's an insult to them, and they feel lost. You kind of want them to be almost with you, and maybe sometimes they may second guess you, but what they shouldn't be able to do is second guess the ending.
Why not?
Well, I think that'd be dissatisfying. You know, that would be... There are shows, there's a different kind of show, you know, and sometimes we have a show that we did like this. Sometimes you do a show where you tell the audience who the killer is right up front, like the one I just talked about, and then you're second guessing his moves to save people. There's another kind of show where you tell the audience who the bad guy is, and then you say, well, we know he's the bad guy, but how are we going to get him? He's too smart. And then the audience goes on that ride, and they think, well, you could get him by this or that, or why don't, you know. And it isn't really an investigation to find out who done it. It's an investigation to find out how you get the guy that done it.
What's the process of plotting the murder mystery part of the programs like? Do you know, when you start the plotting, do you know who did it and what their motive was, and then try to figure out all of the intricate plot details in between?
Well, you know, I wish there was some magic sort of way of doing that. And maybe somebody, I've heard that the great writers have like a way of just doing it. I don't really know. I usually work at it from who's the bad person? What have they done? What are their goals? What would they have done right and what would they have done wrong? And then what they did right is going to be harder to find out. And of course, when you do it, I think, well, what they've done right actually turns out to be wrong, because they've outsmarted themselves, and there's a lot of satisfaction in that.
In a lot of, I know, like a lot of literature teachers will say, the last thing you want to do in a short story is end it by saying, and then I woke up and found out it was all a dream. It's like a terrible escape. You can't do that. What are some of the things you can't do that you tell your writers they can't do when writing a crime story?
Well, in our show, for example, they can't break point of view. They can't see something, hear something, bring an awareness to the story of something that our characters would not have seen or would not have experienced. Because when you go with our characters, you go as like there's two cops, you go as the third cop. Mm-hmm. And you see it as they see it, and you don't see something that they wouldn't see, and you never, I mean, hopefully you don't, and you never should. And that makes... You know, sometimes dramatically, you think, gosh, this would be great if we could just show this, but you can't show it because the cops wouldn't have seen it. So those are limitations you impose on yourself for this kind of storytelling. And that's something we don't even violate it in terms of the camera. Like if the door hasn't opened a crack and the cops are coming through, you can't be in the room. So you could have gotten through the crack in the door before they did, but you can't be in there waiting for the door to open.
Right.
And we keep very true to that.
What else can't you do?
The other thing, there are certain rules, but basically we look at them and try to figure out ways to break them. You know, they would say, for example, well, you should, in a dramatic television show, the big dramatic turn on the show should come at an act break. And I, that's one I personally like to violate. I mean, I like to throw, for example, in the first show, you know, killings happen right in the middle of an act, and it's not the act out. Because I think that way it's harder for people to anticipate. It makes them edgier, and they're not sure, you know, they don't get the comfort of thinking, oh, okay, well, this person's dead, now it's going to be the end of act two, you know. And you do things like that that are deliberate, and I think part of good storytelling, that prevent the anticipation of things.
Hill Street Blues had such a different kind of writing style than, say, Law and Order and Dragnet, in the sense that Hill Street was so much about the personal lives and the characters of the cops. You know, you found out what crimes they were working on and so on, but it would also follow them outside of their work, and you'd see all the problems they were having at home and in relationships. And Law and Order and Dragnet are police procedurals, where you really don't see the characters outside of their job. And it's really, those shows are dedicated to solving the crimes.
Well, there are two different kinds of shows. A character-driven show doesn't usually, as a rule, you don't concentrate very much on the stories because, for example, in Hill Street or NYPD Blue or, you know, any sort of well-done character-driven show, you might run three stories or even more through the show. You might run four stories. Like, and they're called modulars because you can decide, you have a grab bag of stories and you're going to tell them in X number of beats. And so you go through the bag and you say, okay, well, this story is probably the A story. It's the strongest story. This will be the A story of the episode. And then you're intercutting those with the B stories, the C stories, maybe a D story. And then you weave the personal stuff through that. So it's a very different kind of storytelling. It's a lot more, I mean, it's a lot more like soap opera, where your engagement in the show is, yeah, you're engaged in the stories and you want to see these guys solve the crimes or fail to solve them, and you want good stories. But mainly you want to know how, what's happening with your characters. How are the relationships going between them and other characters? And people engage very closely with these people. And it's interesting, I mean, one interesting thing that I noted is that they really care more about how the characters that are the running characters on the show interact with each other than they do about how they interact with the criminals and so forth that they run into. You can have an excellent guest actor come in and do something with one of your leads. They're more interested in how that lead interacted with another lead. Mm-hmm. So the strength is not in the story, I guess is what I'm saying.
Do you have any preference for the character-driven versus the police procedural?
As a writer, just, you know, writing myself, mm-hmm. I would rather write character-driven. It's easier for me to write. I don't like plotting very much, you know. I do it, and it's just not as much fun. You don't get to stretch out as much in terms of human behavior of your principles because, you know, you're not keeping them just on a cause and effect course, you know. But I like both shows. I'm proud of both shows. I mean, I worked on NYPD Blue and ER and Hill Street. Those are character-driven shows. And I really like some of the episodes that I wrote on those shows or was involved in, you know, developing. But then some of the stuff I did on Law and Order, you know, where you can deal with issues, which you probably should stay away from on character-driven shows, you know, where we did the Crown Heights story and things like that that raised issues of constitutional law or you know, what's right, what's wrong, what's ethical, what's not ethical. You don't get to do those as much on a character show, and that's a lot of fun to do, too.
You know, it strikes me that in the United States, a lot of people are very ambivalent about cops. They feel the need for protection. They want to be safe. They want law and order in the streets. But on the other hand, a lot of people feel that cops can be intrusive. That they're sometimes stopping the wrong people, or that they can be racist in who they decide to stop, et cetera, et cetera. But people are not ambivalent about cop shows. I mean, I think just people love cop shows. Have you thought about that a lot, the ambivalence people seem to have about cops and the absolutely love they have of cop shows?
Well, yes. I think the reason people, you know, feel ambivalent about cops, and we all do, I mean, I do too, and yet like cop shows, is that they can choose a cop show that makes them feel sort of safe about cops, and then they can enjoy what they would like to enjoy about cops. And because I think, you know, cops are basically hired to do something we don't want to do. We don't want to go out and shoot at people and stop bullets and beat people if they're, you know, if they're dangerous or apprehend them. We don't want to do those things. So we hire other people to do that for us. And we'd like to think that there's something heroic about what they're doing. And cop shows, for the most part, even though they may show people as being weak in one way or another or reacting badly, they don't really show the misfits unless they're specifically designed to do that. And to justify showing the sort of better side of cops, I think that probably, I mean, the majority of most police are just guys doing this job and trying to do it well. But like anything else, the screening process is not perfect. And there are people, you know, on the street being cops who should probably be in jail. And, you know, but that's just life.
I think the best example of the ambivalence that people have about cops and the love they have of cop shows is Ice-T, who's on a Law & Order SUV. I always say SUV, SVU, Special Victims Unit. And, you know, as a rapper, Ice-T had some very anti-police kind of recordings, but, you know, he plays a cop and plays a cop quite well on the Law & Order show.
Yes, I've heard him speak about it, actually. And, you know, he said sort of a different version of what I just said, that, you know, he could do that because he knew that there was a need for cops, and he knew that there were cops who were good guys. And even though that was not his own personal experience, you know, from which he drew, you know, the lyrics that you're referring to. And I think that's everybody's story. If you're a minority, it's certainly probably more your story than someone like myself. But, it's an important thing to call attention to this, because the cops themselves have to constantly screen themselves, and they have to find a way to walk this very narrow line, because there are times when it's very tempting to just be effective but do something illegal, and they cannot do that. I mean, it's interesting that Bill Stoner, who is our technical advisor, is a retired RHD cop, is far more conservative, and I don't mean that politically at all, but he's far more conservative in what he thinks police should be allowed to do than we are, you know, who are doing the show. And we consider ourselves very, you know, we're liberal guys. And he's a guy who really thinks that cops shouldn't even swear. You know, they shouldn't use foul language because they have to be a paragon. He said that you've armed them and given them the right to carry a gun. They can't have the same rights as other people. They can't allow themselves the same lassitude that other people do in society. They have to be special.
Hey, that's an interesting perception. Did that get you thinking that maybe you should have your characters feel that way too and conform to that?
I think it's a little too much. You know, I think it would be unreal. I mean, now the original Joe Friday was more along those lines, but I didn't believe it, and I especially didn't believe it watching the show in the 60s. You know, but... But there is a real example. I mean, Bill Stoner is that guy. He will never use an epithet or even, he won't even hear an off-color joke, you know, as an officer of the law.
Has writing and producing police stories for television made you see police any differently?
Well, yes, it made me see police differently, because before I started writing cop shows, I'm in the 60s and so forth. I associated police with bigotry and head bashing and, you know, kind of reactionary fascist elements. But then as I started working on these shows, you know, and meeting the people that were connected with them in a technical, you know, advisory capacity or for stories and so forth, you know, I met them and got to know them, and I saw that that my perspective was very narrow of what police were, and that they were incredibly dedicated people. And the other thing I saw that was interesting that surprised me was that police are often more tolerant and liberal about human behavior than people who consider themselves very liberal. You can meet very tough cops who will, you know, when the public says, well, this guy's a murderer and a killer and he stabbed this woman 62 times, you know, say, well, this is a working guy and things, you know, got very rough for him and his life started to fall apart and, you know, it just, a lot of stuff came together and he couldn't deal with it, and it's just a tragic thing that happened to him because he's not a bad guy. And, you know, they'll take a point of view because of what they see that is not only not hardened by the experience, but is much softer than someone reading the newspaper about a man who stabs a woman 65 times and says, this guy's a monster, you know, kill him or do whatever.
Do you get stopped much by cops? Has that happened to you?
I do get stopped occasionally for really silly things, too.
Like?
But you mean, well, they're usually traffic, you know.
Uh-huh. And do you mention your job?
No, I don't.
When you are stopped, do you find yourself studying the officer who's ticketing you so that you can get material?
No, actually, I don't. I think we all study the cop who stops us because there's a certain anxiety. Well, certainly in mm-hmm. California, there's a certain anxiety level. You know, you think, I don't want to be misread. I mean, because you read about people they reached for their wallet and got shot or something like that. So I'm extremely cooperative, and I think I have that. I don't know if fear is the right word, but I certainly have that caution that we all have, you know, in interacting with the police, especially in traffic situations and in L.A. Now, New York's very different. I've never, or the East Coast, I don't know Philadelphia cops at all, but like in New York, cops are so easy to talk to and they're so accessible. But out here, it's very, very different.
You actually started making movie or TV documentaries. What kind of documentaries were they, and did that help with doing cop shows?
Well, I did start making documentaries for David Wolper, who virtually gave me my first job off the street because I didn't know anything about it, movie making or filmmaking or writing or anything else. And I started as a researcher, and then I got to fix a show that was in trouble about Nazis in South America because I'd been in South America. And they sent me to South America and let me look for Mengele and Bormann and find people who knew them and so forth and do that. That was like my first sort of job. And then because I was always a natural history buff, the National Geographic series started and the Cousteau series. And it was one of those really good lucky breaks because I was the guy at the organization who actually knew, you know, something about nature. And I got to do, I think, 5 National Geographic specials, and I worked on the Cousteaus and was on Calypso and all that. It was wonderful. But I didn't do any writing then. I only directed and produced.
Did directing and producing documentaries give you an idea of what real life should look like and what you wanted fiction to look like when you wanted the fiction to look like real life?
Yes, documentaries do give you that. I also had, I liked reality-based, you know, films. And it was always, even when I was a kid, you know, I liked, for example, when I was, you know, 11, 12, 13, I liked films like Shoeshine and Bicycle Thief and neorealist films and things like that. because I liked things that looked like life, you know, that I actually thought, well, that's life. That's the way those people live. And I liked that a lot in the European cinema of the time, and then the Americans, you know, started making films that touched on neorealism too, Naked City, films like that. And it's just, I can't explain why, but it was my preference over science fiction and, you know, things like that. That didn't really interest me that much.
You wrote the screenplay for the movie The Wild Bunch, which was directed by Sam Peckinpah. It was made in the late 60s. And it's basically considered a landmark in brutal violence in American cinema. It's a movie in which there's no real good guys, per se. People are really brutal and mean. The violence is really ugly, and it's very, for that period, very explicit. I mean, you see blood spurting out of bullet wounds. Women are shot. These are things you weren't really seeing at the time in movies. And some of the violence is shown in slow motion. Did you write the film with a sense that you wanted it to have that place in history as a landmark in brutal violence?
I didn't write the film thinking it would be a landmark in history. I mean, that surprises me. I mean, I really wrote the film because it was a film I wanted to see. I had seen a lot of Westerns. They were usually heroic. Some of them were very good. And they played to these mythic characters. And I thought, you know, I'd lived in Mexico for a while, and I'd also hung out with a lot of cowboys at that time, you know, that were guys that worked in the stockyards and stuff like that. And it was a very violent culture. I mean, they sat around and talked about fights they'd been in or wanted to be in, and they had this penchant for that. And the only sort of redeeming thing that I found about them was that as violent and sociopathic as they were, they did have this incredible sense of bond, you know, I mean, of camaraderie. And even to the point of, I mean, idiocy. Like, one of them once, he robbed an unemployment office in Burbank. And they all went and perjured themselves, even though they didn't like him. I mean, he was somebody they didn't like. They actually, some of them hated him, but they went and perjured themselves to try and get him off. He didn't get off. He might have even been executed. I don't remember what happened to him. But I thought there was this one element of them that had some nobility. And I thought, how weird, what a weird contrast that these people who have all this disdain for, you know, the traditional values of society have this one thing. I mean, and it was very, very strong. And I thought that's an interesting idea. And I would imagine that's probably what people in the early West were like. They lived in a very violent world. They made, the law was whatever the governing powers decided to make it, you know, such as railroads and so forth. And so they created this code, and like in the same way that predatory animals will usually not enact predation against each other, they have ritualized combat, which they don't hurt each other, and they will stick together. That's what these people are like, and I thought it went back to very basic element of behavior. So that became sort of the theme of the film.
Did you and Peckinpah, the director, talk a lot about how the violence should be shown visually?
We didn't talk a lot about it, but he read the script and just got it. He said, at that time, the films that were the inspiration for myself, and as it turned out for Peckinpah, although we didn't know each other before I wrote the script, were the Kurosawa films, you know.
Like Seven Samurai?
Like Seven Samurai and Rashomon, and this was before Yojimbo, I think, or Yojimbo might have been out, I don't remember. And, you know, we thought, well, that's it. I mean, that's probably what combat really looks like. And then occasionally Kurosawa he was the first person, I think, to use slow motion in combat. In Seven Samurai, there's one slow motion shot. I think there's two slow motion shots in the film.
Do you ever look at violence, at explicit violence on film now and think, oh, that's going too far?
Well, I thought, yes, I do. And not so much by the level of violence, but by the use of violence. You know what I mean? Like, I've seen films that don't particularly seem that violent, if you heard it, because they're supposedly silly. But sometimes there's too much sort of joy in the violence. And I think that's, I mean, it's to get you off, I guess, is what I'm saying. And I always hoped that that wasn't what we saw in The Wild Bunch, although obviously people did go see it and liked that aspect of it and got off on it. I mean, it was really to show that the world is just an immensely cruel place, and even a 12-year-old kid gets wound up and excited by this kind of action and picks up a gun and shoots a guy in the face with it, you know?
There was a time when people assumed that if you were a serious writer, the place for you was movies, and TV was the place to make money, but, you know, it was not the place to really practice your craft in the way that film was. Do you ever feel that it's sometimes the opposite, that the writer's more respected in television than in film?
Yes, the writer is much more respected in television than in film. And in fact, if somebody told me they wanted to write dramatic material, you know, and really cared about what they wrote, I would probably say, I don't know anything about the theater, but maybe that's good. Film is probably the most depressing place for a writer. I mean, you have about the same status as Kleenex, you know. And, I mean, producers, Don Simpson said, I don't consider I've done justice to a script unless at least 20 writers have worked on it. So, you're easily picked up, you're easily discarded, your views, you know, whatever original views you had, are of no significance, really. It's extremely rare, even if you're a respected writer, there's a honeymoon period, and then there's the period where they decide what the movie should be, and you may not be part of that. In television, because you stay with the project, and directors come and go, you do have a way, if you can do it within the confines of what that project is, you do have a way of saying things. I mean, I think Norman Lear has put a real stamp on, you know, getting what he feels to the American public, certainly more successfully than any writer I can think of in the motion picture business.
Well, Waylon Greene, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Waylon Greene is now an executive producer of Dragnet, which is broadcast on ABC TV.